Hello, I'm Peter Donat. In the previous programs of Transformations of Myth Through Time, Joseph Campbell has spoken of mythic forms specific to cultures as different as the Navajo Indian and the ancient Egyptian. However, as we view these programs, we are struck more by the similarities in their mythological themes than we are by their differences. More intimately, perhaps, we recognize in these recurring motifs ideas that lie at the basis of our own religious experience. This program, the first of five programs on the religious experience of the East, of Hinduism and Buddhism, begins with Campbell's discussion of the elementary ideas, ideas that occur universally throughout the history of religions, and which come to us from the very origin of human existence. To Campbell, it is no wonder that these recurring themes are familiar to us. To deny their existence is to deny our spiritual identity with the human race.
Well, my project for this weekend is based on a couple of simple ideas, which I think I should present at the outset so that you'll know what I'm trying to do. The first is the idea that I've discussed here many times of the German anthropologist Adolf Bastian, who recognized that throughout the mythologies and religious systems of the world, the same images, the same themes were constantly recurring, appearing everywhere. And he called these elementary ideas. Elementar Gedanken. But he recognized also that wherever they occurred, they appeared in different costumes, with different applications, and different interpretations. And these provincial differences he called folk ideas, or ethnic ideas, Völkergedanken. Now, this is a very important distinction. It divides our whole subject into two quite different departments: historians and ethnologists are interested in the differences, and one can study the mythologies and philosophies of the world with an accent on these differences. On the other hand, the problem emerges of the elementary ideas. Why are they everywhere? And this is a psychological problem, and it's a problem that separates us in our discussion of comparative forms from the whole research having to do with differences. Now, what I want to do today is, in giving the story of the Oriental systems, to insist on the elementary aspect. Now, the second idea that I have in mind is as follows. Somewhere in the 9th and 8th centuries BC, a shift of accent takes place, particularly in the Orient, where instead of simply presenting the images are interpreted. That's to say, we're going to turn from simply what might be called visual and active relationship to the forms of myth through the imagery of myth and the rituals through which the myth is rendered into life. There was a turn to thinking about these things, interpreting them. And so the Oriental philosophies actually represent a discourse interpreting the elementary ideas. Now, what happened in the West following the period of Aristotle, particularly, was a gradual attack on the mythological ideas, so that criticism in the West tended to separate itself from the elementary ideas. However, there is an undercurrent throughout the Western thinking also It's associated with Gnosticism, alchemy, and many of the discredited manners of thought that carries on this interest in what might be called the perennial. Now, I'm thinking of the perennial philosophy as it has been expounded particularly by Ananda K. Kumaraswamy and picked up, I think it was during the 40s, by Aldous Huxley in that work of his, The Perennial Philosophy. I'm thinking of this as a translation into verbal discourse of the implications of the mythic images. And that's why there can be found in the mystical philosophies throughout the world the same ideas recurring. That is to say, the continuities that we can recognize in myth come over into philosophy. And this is what is known as the perennial philosophy. Now, myth comes from the same zone as dream. And this is the zone of what I would call the wisdom body. When you go to sleep, it's the body that's talking. And what the body is moved by are energies that it does not control. These are the energies that control the body. They come in from the great biological ground, whatever it may be, protoplasm. They're there. They are energies and they are manners of consciousness. But we also have in this body this affair up here of the head, and it has a system of thinking of its own. And there's a whole manner of consciousness that stems from the head set, and it is different in its knowledge from that of the body. When a baby is born, it knows just what to do with its mother's body. It is ready for the environment into which it's put. It doesn't have to be instructed. These things happen. And this is the work of the wisdom body. Also, that same wisdom brought the little thing into form in its mother's body. It was shaped by these energies that live in us, and of which we are the carnal manifestation. This wisdom of the dream, wisdom of the vision, is the wisdom then of the perennial philosophy. When you dream, your waking consciousness aspect does not understand the dream. So you have to go to a psychoanalyst who doesn't understand it either. The interpretation is gradual, and it comes from an exploration by the head of your own wisdom. And so we find that there is a kind of radical distinction between the perennial philosophy in its mode and its axioms, quite different from the axioms and mode of the rational system. And it's out of that other that I want to try to talk today. Now, as I say, the interpretation of the mythic forms went forward in great style, principally in India, very early. And so it's through reviewing the mythologies and the interpretations of the myths in India and then in China and Japan that I propose to introduce us to what I take to be the ground thinking of the perennial philosophy. And so while I want to give a sense of the richness and wonder of the ethnic aspect of the Oriental system, my principal interest today is in extracting from them the elementary, not accenting the ethnic, but extracting the elementary. So that's what I'm going to try to bring forward. Here we are on the Ganges. And on the shore there is Benares. The idea of the sacred river, the Jordan, the waters that pour from heaven, it then becomes translated into the idea of the grace of the divine flowing inexhaustibly out of some source. And in India, at the very source of the Ganges, up in the Himalayan area, it's a very sacred place, and if one goes there, there are yogis all around practicing yoga, getting close to the source, literally. And one of the problems with symbols, and it's the main problem with symbols, is that people tend to get lost in the symbol, so they think they have to go up to the head of the Ganges in order to get to the source. The problem in myth, the problem in mysticism is that you should not lose the message in the symbol. The message always is of the spirit. And when the symbol is taken to be the fact, so that you have to go to Haridwar in order to get to the source of the Ganges, you've mistaken the message. There's a similar mistake made in the notion that you have to go to Israel to get to the promised land. This concretization is one of the major, deceptions in the Western handling of symbols. And it's one of the reasons why we've lost touch with the elementary idea and the perennial messages. The concretization of the symbol. The notion, for example, that God is a fact. The God idea is a symbol. Anything that can be named and regarded as a form is a symbol. There's a wonderful saying of Gerhard Hauptmann, the great German poet. Dichten heißt hinter Wörtern das Urwort erklingen lassen. Writing poetry consists in letting the word be heard behind words. And the whole world of symbols, Goethe's word again. Alles Vergängliche ist nur ein Gleichnis. Everything that is transitory is but a reference. But the reference isn't to anything. It's to what is called the void, shunyata, and is called the void because no thought can reach it. And so what these symbols are talking about is something that can't be talked about. And they have to become transparent. They have to open. And what you find then is that the ethnic opens to the elementary. And one of our problems, and these are the two great sources now of the problem here in Western interpretation of these matters, we have the Aristotelian accent on rational thinking, and we have the biblical aspect on the ethnic reference of the mythic symbol. These two pin us down to the world of facts and rational cogitation. But from this other standpoint, those are exactly what have to be transcended. They have to be rendered transparent and not opaque. So I'm going to try to see the whole Hindu system in that way and by comparison refer over to our Western themes. Here's the idea of the Jordan and baptism, bathing, going into the river, partaking of the grace. But one has to accompany the act with a meditation on its sense. Then we have the idea of the sacred city, the city at the sacred place where the grace flows. And that, of course, is Benares. Benares is the city of Shiva, and who is probably the oldest worshipped god in the high culture systems of the world. This is Shiva's city, and we'll hear a good deal about him today. It's a fantastic mess. Just a jungle of temples. All kinds. And people come there to die. Because, literal reading of the symbol, when you're close to the Ganges, you're close to the divine grace, and it's only a short step then to heaven. So we find them making themselves sick, you might say, by bathing in this filthy water. Only a little bit up the way, they're burning bodies and throwing them into the Ganges, which is a good place to go. Reading the symbol literally again. Whole idea of pilgrimage. There is translating into a literal physical act, the pilgrimage of moving into the center of your own heart. It's good to make a pilgrimage if, while doing so, you meditate on what you're doing and know that it's inward, into your inward life that you're moving. And here we have at the Ghats the people bathing in the Ganges. It's a constant, as it were, baptism rite, going in, absorbing then the virtue of this miraculous gift of the universe, the waters of the Ganges. The Ganges actually is a goddess, Ganga, and this flowing water is the grace that comes to us from the power of the female power, which we'll be talking about later. In Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, he uses the same image for the River Liffey, which flows through Dublin, and Dublin on the River Liffey is precisely the counterpart of Benares on the Ganges. And the whole secret of relating mythology and spiritual life to your environment is here involved. What's called Landnam by the people in Iceland, naming and claiming, through naming, the landscape, land taking. You read the land that you're living in as the holy land. There was a very interesting letter in the Times yesterday from a young Jewish boy who protested against the idea of having to be thought of as in the diaspora, having left the Holy Land. He said, my country, my land is here in the United States, and I have not been forced to be here, and it's my choice and pleasure to name this my Holy Land. I thought this was a wonderful statement of the problem that we have in disengaging ourselves from what might be called traditional inheritance that tends to concretize its own symbol system. He had released himself and found the whole sense of the Holy Land in his own place. And so Joyce does this with the river and the city. His Holy Land, you might say, was Dublin, as ours is New York on the Hudson. But we've so secularized the thing that you won't even get to laugh, thinking of the Hudson as a gift of divine grace. This is what's happened. And now I go back 4,000 years. This is at Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley in northwest India. It's a bathing place. Mohenjo-Daro is one of a little cluster of small cities. This is one of the two largest, that emerged in India 2000 BC. And now we come to the historical matter. Already in this Indus Valley civilization, also called the Dravidian civilization, also called the Mohenjo-Daro civilization, also called the Harappa civilization, see, names don't matter, the reference. We have the emergence of a culture of the style of ancient Crete and Mesopotamia. It's contemporary with those worlds, 2000 BC. And one of the most important buildings in this ruined city is a bath, a public bath. And it's assumed that the importance of this had religious meaning or value, and that a continuity of that, from that, is what we meet when we come to the Ganges. It's a continuous thing for 4,000 years, the sacred water, the bathing in the sacred water. Benares is here on the Ganges, deep into India as we come in from the west. Mesopotamia, the rivers Tigris and Euphrates, is here. It is in this area that the first city civilizations of the world appear. And they appear around 3500 BC. It's becoming clearer and clearer, I think, that all of the high civilizations of the world are reflections from this source. 3500 BC in Mesopotamia, 2500 BC in the Indus area, 1500 BC with the Shang dynasty in China, and then it jumps the ocean, and in Mexico and Peru, we have the Olmec and Chavin phenomena of about 1200 BC. And it's out of these that the high civilization systems come. And when we speak of high civilizations, we speak of a civilization in which there is, except in one case, writing, and in every case, developed mathematics and extreme attention to the cycles of the planets through the constellations. This cycling of the planets through the constellations is the great critical factor in the transformation of consciousness at this time. Because of writing and because of mathematics, it became possible to make records, precise records, of the passage of the planets through the constellations. And in Mesopotamia, as early as 3200 BC, apparently, it became evident that the planets were moving at a mathematically predictable rate. And the notion of a cosmic order, the order of the cosmos, comes into expression. And when people talk about mythology and rituals, they usually talk about it from the standpoint of modern mentality. And they speak about finding the causes of the world, origin myths and so forth. Explanatory myths, what are called etiological myths. That's not what myths are about. Myths do not have to do with analyzing and scientifically discovering causes. Myths have to do with relating the human being to his environment. And his environment before the discovery of these great planetary movements was largely the environment of the animal and plant worlds. So the very early mythologies have to do with relating to the animal world, and the problem there is the animal is respected, and the animal is nevertheless killed and eaten. And the problem of recognizing what might be called a covenant between the animal world and the human world, and recognizing the miracle of life which lives by killing and eating life, is a major problem that has to be solved, relating the mind to this act of continually killing and consuming, wearing the skins of the animals, living in tents made of them, and so forth and so on. That's one aspect. The other is the plant world. Again, you're killing and eating life. And both the animal and the plant are, like the river Ganges, pouring into the world for your sustenance and are revered, and they become the revered powers and symbols to which man must relate himself. But then comes this discovery of the great cycles of the heavens, and what you find is a great concern to relate the whole organization of the society to this cycling. A tremendous accent on seasonal festivals. These festivals are not meant to control nature. They're meant to put you in accord with nature. And when you are in accord with nature, nature will yield its bounty. This is something that's coming up in our own consciousness now in the ecology movement, recognizing that by violating the environment in which we are living, we are really cutting off the energy and the source of our own living. And it's this sense of accord, so that living properly in relation to what has to be done in this world. One fosters the vitality of the environment. And so there you have this business of accord with the natural world. Well, when the great cosmic order was discovered, the problem of coming into accord with that becomes the high system. And we have an echo of it in the prayer, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." The heavenly signs became the signs of the order of the great spiritual world. And now, of course, we're moving past that, since we're sending rockets up there and men have walked on the moon, which was the first spiritual light, you might say. And what we're learning is that the separation of spirit and earth has been transcended. That these two, in some sense, are much more one than the dualism of our inherited philosophy would suggest. So much for the first stage in this whole story. At the time of the emergence of the high civilizations in the river valleys, they were ranging in the great grazing plains of southern Europe, nomadic cattle herding people. These are known as the Indo-Europeans, also known as the Aryans. Aryan is a Sanskrit word meaning nobles. What I'm going to be talking about is the role of these people in India. These are the Vedic Aryans. They come into India, Persia, and into Europe. And now what I want to do for the remainder of the time, yes, is to tell you of the great spiritual crisis that occurred in India after the arrival of the Indo-Europeans. This is when we begin to translate myth into philosophy. The sacred books of India, the fundamental sacred books, are known as the Vedas. The word Veda is from a Sanskrit root vid, V-I-D, that means knowledge. And the Vedas are manifestations of knowledge. And the knowledge is a specific kind of knowledge. It's called Shruti, and Shruti means heard. The rishis, or saints, were people who did not invent the poems, the hymns of the Vedas. The Vedas are collections of hymns. They heard them. Just as anyone who listens to the muse will hear. You can write either out of your own intention or out of inspiration. There is such a thing. It comes up and talks. And those who have heard deeply the rhythms and hymns and words of the gods can recite those hymns in such a way that the gods will be attracted. So that the Vedas are books of hymns, and these hymns form the substance of the rituals by which the powers of nature, personified as gods, are invoked to the support of the intentions of the Aryan society. You invoke the gods to do your will. And so the characteristic leadership of these tribes is one of a warrior leader and the other of a magician, of the rishi, who can invoke the gods. So we have two kinds of power going. These are the twin heroes. You have a similar thing in the early part of Exodus, where you have Moses and Aaron, the warrior chief and the priest. But at a certain important moment, the warrior chief had the higher revelation. He went up Mount Sinai, and the God with the horns of light spoke to him a new message. And when he came down, there was poor Aryan still worshiping bulls, the old symbol of the cycle of time. And Moses then goes to work, gets angry, breaks the laws, goes back, gets a second edition, comes back again. And then takes place, I want to bring this up, takes place a very interesting ritual. He grinds up the golden bull. and mixes it with water and makes everybody take a communion meal. Did you ever notice that? That's what happens there. And then from then on, of course, Aaron is out, and Moses is in the two roles. And so out of that tradition, we have the same kind of thing that comes with the caliphs of the Islamic world, where the spiritual ruler and the political ruler are the same ruler. These two things are brought very closely together, so that spirit and society are very closely united.